This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. The past 2 weeks on this program, we've focused on the solo voice, but in the coming weeks, we'll mass these voices together into choral ensembles. And this week, we'll visit with an ensemble whose makeup is sadly not as common or expected as one might think, the Boston-based all-female Lorelei Ensemble. And we'll chat with their artistic director, Beth Willer, who began the group over a decade ago. With few established groups of more than, say, an anonymous four to look to, Lorelei began building through impressive and creative programming and an aggressive and proactive commissioning policy to position themselves as one of the premier treble or female voice ensembles. The group is made up of singers who all have distinguished careers in their own right, scattered throughout the eastern portion of the U.S., but who come together to form this group because of the importance of promoting and commissioning. They've premiered over 50 new works and performing music for women's chorus. Ms. Willer, for example, is assistant professor and director of choral activities at Bucknell University. Their creative programming is evidenced on their recordings, and they have a new CD out on the Sono Luminous label titled Impermanence, and focuses on areas common to their repertoire, early music and contemporary music. This disc features music of 15th century composer Guillaume Dufay, as well as music of the 20th century Japanese composer Toro Takemitsu, and a new work by Peter Gilbert, as well as music from the anonymous sourced Turin Codex, music from Italy and Cyprus from the 14th century. You're listening to them perform a selection from that codex, Qui Patris Atris Honoris and Paraclete Spiritus. I spoke with Beth Willer by phone from her home in central Pennsylvania back in late November. Talking with Beth Willer, who is the founder, the director, and at times one of the alto voices in the Lorelei Ensemble. Congratulations on this Boston-based group. You've crossed the 10-year mark. That's something to really be proud of, probably these days in the arts.
Thank you, yes.
So the group, as we're going to talk about in a few minutes, the group kind of started a little bit as a pickup ensemble, but has blossomed into this group of singers, again, all women who are, to a person, have really vibrant careers outside of the group, spanning early music, Baroque, concert opera, contemporary. What's your ideal size right now for Lorelei?
Consistently, we have had a roster of 9 voices, including myself, which, like you said, I can function as a conductor or as a vocalist, depending on the piece and the program. So that's been consistently our size. And we have a core membership that stays together and tours and also self-produces in Boston.
Not that you have to get a new voice in or replace someone, but what are you looking for as a group, as far as a singer, a voice to be part of Lorelei? What are you looking for?
Right. Well, our repertoire does really settle mostly in early and contemporary repertoires. And right. So I do look for a certain amount of familiarity with either one or both of those repertoires and an expertise that's going to map well onto the work that we're doing. But perhaps even more important, when I'm auditioning someone, when we're meeting someone for the first time, on top of their musicianship and their interest in the work that we're doing, someone that has a career as a soloist, someone that is interested in doing both ensemble and solo singing. singing and then bridging that gap. And I think there's a number of great ensembles doing that work right now to champion the vocal art as a really flexible art form, and that folks that have the willingness and the ability to go between styles and perhaps even different vocal techniques, that really lends to a more exciting ensemble sound that can lend itself then to the repertoire in a more exciting way.
We're going to talk later about your programming, but it is not unusual to find Lorelei ensemble singing alongside instrumentalists, alongside something else. So it is not just strictly an a cappella presentation. A lot of your programs, probably when one thinks of a women's singing group, one of the most successful and visible over the past decades was Anonymous Four. But if you move that metric to a larger ensemble, it gets a little bit more or less well known. You grew up, as I did, a good Lutheran. So whether we sang the hymns or in choir, we were pounded with SATB in our head all the time.
Right.
You attended Luther College and then got to Boston. So how did the notion or the sound for you of a female chorus come to you, and that it would be something that you could form and be successful? Maybe take us through, that'll lead us into the genesis of the group.
Sure. Well, you're right that I come from this Lutheran tradition. And of course, I've been singing in choirs since I was quite tiny. I'm originally from South Dakota, and I found myself at Luther College in Iowa, which we're actually going to this weekend, so I'm very excited to be back in my alma mater. And my experience at Luther started with a freshman women's choir, which was the mandatory separation of men and women's voices right in our first year. And I had never sung in an all-trouble choir. In fact, in high school, I had convinced my choir director to not make me do that, but to make the freshman ensemble mix. So I was thoroughly convinced by culture that an all-trouble ensemble could not be excellent and was not worth my time, until I had this experience as a freshman at Luther, and I had an amazing exposure to some higher quality treble repertoire under the direction of Sandra Peter, and I was taken by that experience. And of course, after that, I moved on to mixed choirs for the rest of my time at Luther, and I didn't continue in that vein, but I had this experience that had shaped me in a really profound way in that first year. And so when I went into teaching right after college, I also thrived with a freshman women's choir at a high school in Wisconsin and really enjoyed working with them. And it was in that time and transitioning into my first year or so at Boston University as a graduate student that I became more aware of the imbalance of repertoire for mixed choir and treble choir, and really seeing that the quality of the repertoire, but also just which composers took the time to write music for all treble voices, was far more limited. And even when a great composer was writing for a treble chorus, it wasn't their most sophisticated repertoire, and certainly not the most sophisticated poetry. And so I saw this gap, and I was interested to address that. And as a master's student at BU, I made a decision to put a group of 9 women together to perform a bit of repertoire that was more challenging than the collegiate choir I was conducting could pull off. And that evolved gradually, one project after another, into commissioning new works and unearthing some of these early repertoires that had had less attention or had not been performed by women. And that then, of course, evolved into a mission and an actual organization that has continued that work now for over 10 years.
So when you started, I mean, obviously you got this kicking around with friends and acquaintances who wanted to sing. How did other women, as you went, find out about it, and then they would join, knowing that this is something they wanted to do, but this would also be something that would be successful? I don't know if you get the gist of my question. Why would they latch on to this? How did the word get out, type of thing?
Sure. I mean, Boston is, of course, a wonderfully saturated artistic community. There are a lot of amazing artists there, and a few of the folks who ended up being initial core members were people that had just come into the city and were looking for work, and we had mutual acquaintances. But I also think, and this is, of course, a hypothesis, I don't have any evidence, but I do think there is something in this particular generation that I came up in, but also the generation following us, that young women were looking for opportunities that empowered them as women.
Right.
And as this being something that was artistically compelling, and as an ensemble that was taking some risks in terms of doing new repertoire with incorporation of other media or early repertoire that they wouldn't be able to experience in a mixed ensemble. And so the fact that the work that we were doing was a bit unpredictable,
yeah,
I think, for a lot of young creatives in Boston, which is an innovative place, you know, a city of startups, that kind of artistic work was really appealing to a lot of people at that point in our career. And then, of course, that launched into something more stable eventually. But I think part of the excitement was that it felt like a startup. It
yeah.
felt like a little innovation hub that we all kind of didn't know where it was going to go. And we were excited to see what we could do.
Yeah, sort of going out into uncharted territory or waters, as it
right.
were. Yeah, and doing it together. Turning to another recording by Lorelei Ensemble, is led by their artistic director and my guest today, Beth Willer. This is from a composer's voice you hear often on the Classical Network, from the concerts he curates at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang. This is his I Want to Live from 2005 from the Lorelei Ensemble's recording titled Live, Know, Love. Before we get to rep, I want to just talk a little bit about sound. There are a few choice adjectives which get bounced around when describing an all-woman vocal ensemble, and some of them I know kind of grate on you, but one would be one would be pure. What are you? What were you striving for? I saw that you like to use the term robust unison, which I like. I like that a lot. But, I mean, what kind of sound are you striving for?
Well, I guess I'd back up for a moment and
okay.
just also admit that any descriptors for vocal ensembles, period, tend to be limited, whether we're talking about alt treble or even mixed. And yeah. I think we have, both within our vocal community and without, a limited vocabulary for describing ensemble singing. And I think that's partially a result of cultivating a certain kind of ensemble singing sound in our country or in the UK or wherever one might tend to listen to vocal ensemble music. There's a sound that we expect. And I think, again, there are a number of ensembles doing really exciting work to change that right now. And part of that is about championing individual vocal qualities and not always asking for a transparent or a sound that is really so uniform that it has actually taken away the individual qualities of the people on the stage, which we are, you know, increasingly in a culture that champions individuals and our ability to express ourselves as unique beings. And so, not to say that Lorelei is not cultivating a unified sound, but the question in the back of my mind is, how can we do that and champion these amazing and diverse people that are making sound on the stage? And so the words such as pure or ethereal or, you know, even transparent, those can be complementary and words that describe really beautiful sound, but I think they don't make room for all of the incredible diversity of sound that we're all capable of making. So words that I think I'm interested in are rooted or robust or raw, sometimes, you know, sounds that are aching, or that there be some human quality in the sounds that we are making, that it's not about stripping away our experience and our personality in order to find one collective sound, but that we really think about imbuing the sounds that we make with real, earthy, honest feeling right. and expression. And I think not only is this a problem, again, for treble ensembles, but really for any vocal ensemble that we have these expectations. And so it's exciting to be a part of this change. I think it's happening kind of across the board in vocal music right now, especially with smaller groups like Lorelei.
I think you're right. I think critics or whomever trying to describe it, and you know, if you think on the instrumental side, I mean, you want the idea of having an ensemble, which could be the word blend, and the individual, which could right. be the word balance, right? Because that means
right.
everything. And then they tend to just fall back on these same.
Right.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it does kind of afflict, you know, women's groups where you get this sort of bounce back to pure angelic sound, and it's
right.
like, well, let's, you know, time to wrap that up.
One more thing. I think a lot of, especially our expectations for treble sound, of course, come from sounds that we have learned to love that are based in ensembles that had men and boys singing those
right.
high parts,
right.
which, of course, is, again, a beautiful sound, but a different sound and certainly not the same instrument as a mature soprano or alto female voice.
Right.
And so allowing ourselves to broaden that preference and even prefer something that is exceptional, prefer a sound that is not what we expect, I think that's the leap that a listener and even a conductor or a singer themselves has to make.
No, I agree.
That
yeah.
the unexpected can be actually really beautiful.
Yeah, so the words that would normally fit the boy choir don't normally have to fit the all-female choir.
Right.
Repertoire, as I said, we get back, a wide range here, as you mentioned,
yep.
all the way back to ancient. By that, I mean a lot of things that are completely anonymous, early music. And there is a gap there, if you want to talk about it, and then to new music. Mm-hmm. How do you find what's going to fit, meaning you find it and it's going to work, as opposed to something that you would need to arrange or transpose? And is anything you come across, I can't think of a better word from this, and not going to be appropriate for Lorelei? I mean, how do you work through this material?
Sure. I mean, I do think that the most important work we do is with contemporary music, because
yeah.
that allows us to work outside of the norms that were shaping early repertoire, which usually did not include the female voice as an instrument. So I think contemporary music has the most potential to move the art form forward. But in our work with early rep, what I'm looking for, first of all, I think what I started with at the very beginning of Lorelei was to find those pockets where music actually was being written for women, whether that was in a convent or that was in, you know, a high court where there were professional women being hired to sing like the Concerto delle Donne. And so there is that repertoire, but
right.
there are very limited pockets of course. And so you kind of hit the bottom of that barrel very quickly. And then, of course, there's fantastic early repertoire that was certainly intended for male voices. And some of that can map well onto an all treble ensemble. And I think that's a hard thing for me to summarize. But what we're working with, of course, are quite low contralto voices that can cover a number of tenor parts, and also mezzo sopranos that would be in a similar range as a countertenor, what we would call today in the modern times a countertenor. And then, of course, there are some upper parts that will actually work for a soprano. And so rarely, and I think I could say never, have I rearranged a Renaissance piece, but rather only transposed it. So to really preserve the relationships of the vocal parts, mm-hmm. and to find pieces that can shift most often by a minimal interval of a second or maybe a third that will then sort of set 3 to 4 or more voices in our ensemble in an ideal range where they really have a true resonance that can do a service to the music. And my question is always, what can a group of all women's voices lend to this piece? And if I think that it's not lending something more or at least equal to what an ensemble of the originally intended voices would lend, then maybe it's not worth us putting our stamp on it. Right. I think in this album, the Dufay motets, you know, most of them were actually performing at the original notated pitch. And it's simply that we are performing them with different vocal types than originally intended, or even parts that would have been instrumental that we are then singing. And so I think in those cases, those particular 4 motets, they map incredibly well onto the voices that I have in the ensemble right now, which really puts a lot of priority on those low contraltos and some of the lower mezzos even to carry the load. And that's a rare find, but I think it lends something completely different to that repertoire than if you were to listen to an alto tenor bass ensemble.
Before we get to new music, just one more point on the old music. A lot of this music you'll get has no prescribed parameters, dynamics, or anything
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you bring it in and you work with it, is it like a democratic thing on how you approach some of these early things? Do you do all the work and then give it to the group? I mean, how does that work? Because it's very open to interpretation. You know?
Sure. And I mean, that's part of why we love it. It almost feels like new music sometimes
yeah.
because there are so many choices to make. And I do tend to make a lot of those decisions myself in advance, or I find an edition. In this case, we are singing from Alejandro Planchart's editions of the Dufay. And then, of course, making some decisions in addition to the modern editions we're performing from. But I tend to make a lot of those myself. And then in the process of performing them, because in the Dufay, I'm not conducting, I'm coaching. They also are going to obviously have opinions about the ficta and about the dynamics and how we might treat certain phrases. And so we definitely have a lot of conversation about that in this repertoire, particularly because when you're one on a part, you know, there is an ownership of the gestures that you are delivering and making sure that everyone in the group really feels convinced by those decisions that we're making.
Turning to the Lorelei Ensemble's newest recording on the Sono Luminous label, a work by the featured early composer on the disc, Guillaume Dufay, who lived from 1397 to 1474, this is his Flos Florum. The Lorelei Ensemble is led by their artistic director and my guest today, Beth Willer. So if we flip to the other side of the scale, new music, more than 50 commissions, who knows how many premieres you guys have sung. How do you filter who you're going to, you know, perform, maybe commission, work with as a composer, and then take that thread and lead it to what I think is really exciting, and that's been happening now for a while, is the kind of the reemergence of the performer and composer. And one might think, well, yeah, but they're a choir. Yeah, but if you look at composers like Kati Agosh and even go to Caroline Shaw or somebody like that, these are performing singers who are also composing at a really high level. So talk about, you know, how you find composers and maybe even use Kati as an example, but I mean how you work with someone who is also a singer as a composer.
Right. I think that, you know, initially for Lorelei, it came very much from personal connections from programs that I or other members of the ensemble were involved in, other new music ensembles in the city of Boston that, you know, I would go to a concert and hear something I really liked and go to that person and say, what do you think about writing for Lorelei? And of course, a lot of those folks, I might say the majority of the people that have written for us have never written a piece for 8 or 9 women's voices.
Yeah.
So it is a risk for anyone that's written for us to try to figure that out. It's a bit of a different beast. And so I've also looked for, especially considering how interested we are in featuring individuals in the ensemble, people that are really excellent at writing songs, that understand how to write a vocal line. There's a lot of quote-unquote choral music out there right now that I think doesn't explore the full capability of the vocal line. Right. There's a lot of verticality to it, and people that understand how to take care of individual expression within an ensemble. And so some of those folks are people that I've sought out outside of the Boston community, but we really started there. Once we've done enough new music, people start to know who we are and seek us out and say, I'd really like you to consider looking at my work. We've done a call for scores, which I don't think is always the best way to go about finding new music, but that has exposed us to a couple of folks that were interesting. And I think it's just a matter of entrenching ourselves even more in the broad community of new music ensembles and people that we just, you know, happen to rub elbows with at an event and really be interested in the work that they're doing and to start that conversation. And sometimes those conversations, you know, go on for years before we actually end up collaborating. Actually, Kati, she and I had spoken multiple times before our work with the Boston Modern Orchestra project came to fruition. We were brainstorming about how it was that we might like to work together. And I think I could say that for any number of composers. And ultimately, the project that we end up with, those ones that take a couple of years to really form tend to be the ones that have a more lasting impact because we sat with them as people and got to know each other a little bit better in that process.
You know, just to the composer-performer aspect, is that you're working
with
some of these composers who join right in or, you know, are part of the performance, you know?
And we actually haven't done all that much of that. I am interested. In fact, I'm working on conceiving of a project with a couple of different fantastic composer performers from other instrumental ensembles, new music ensembles that might be joining us in a couple of years for a project. And I think there is a rise of that, and it's very exciting to be a part of this shift of who the creator is, that doesn't have to be something that's, you know, pulled out of the performance world, and that we have this brief interaction with someone who, you know, hands us a piece of paper and says, see you at the premiere. I mean, I think this idea of co-creation and collaboration in the composition process is far more likely when one is working with someone who themselves is active in the industry as a performer. And I think that that will likely be more of our future, but I would just say the future of new music in our country, certainly I see that happening quite a bit more. And I think we're going to end up with a repertoire that reflects the industry more genuinely than maybe what we've had in more recent decades.
I agree with you there.
Thank you.
Here are the opening minutes from Hungarian-American composer Kati Ágos's setting of a text by Szilárd Borbély and a nod to the composer's homeland, her Debrecen Passion, named after the second largest city in Hungary. My guests today, the Lorelei Ensemble, perform with the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, led by their music director and former Cadenza guest, Gil Rose. Before we get to programming, last thing on new music, of course, some of the pieces you've commissioned or premiered are your standard choral work. It might last 2 to 6 minutes, but some of the pieces have major breadth and multi-movement. They're big pieces, and I'm just wondering, you perform them, but how do they translate for that composer and for Lorelei maybe giving the premiere or doing the commissioning to being performed by other groups? I mean, those big things. I'm just curious how that's worked
out. Yeah. Again, I would say that's something we've started doing more recently, and I think it's probably the part of the repertoire for treble voices that is the most severely lacking.
Yeah.
So miniature works for treble voices, you know, you can come by those in the standard repertoire, but if you're looking for a choral orchestral work, you know, every 4 years you're going to have to cycle through the same pieces, and a lot of those are written for younger voices. So we've made a priority, I've set a priority of commissioning more works like that, and I think they're in many cases more likely to have more performances by other ensembles. For example, we commissioned an extended work by James Kallenbach paralleling the stories of Antigone and Sophie Scholl of the White Rose movement. And that was for 8 treble voices and cello quartet. And that piece already, we have plans to perform it with collegiate choirs at Bucknell University, at Harvard University. We'll be taking it on tour again in the following season. And that kind of work, it tells a longer story. It delves into a deeper cultural history that I think treble ensembles, especially collegiate ensembles, and I say that as a professor myself, are really looking for programming for treble ensembles that has more depth, that has a story that is applicable to more people than just women. And I don't mean to say just women as if that's not important. I think we need to champion as many stories as possible. But we as women want to tell stories that are important to our whole communities, right? And something like Antigone and Sophie Scholl, I mean, that's got incredible weight for us in these times on many levels. So we've got a number of young ensembles that are very interested in performing that. We're also in the midst of initiating another work with Symphony and Lorelei that would be premiered a couple seasons down the road. That would be an extended work of 35 to 40 minutes. You know, these works obviously take more resources. They take more time to conceive. But ultimately, I think these are pieces that people are looking for, and people are eager to see these created and performed again and again. So there's a demand for that rep, I think, that is stronger even than that for just the shorter a cappella works.
That's good news. That's really great news.
Yeah, definitely.
Turning back to Lorelei Ensemble's recording titled Live, Know, Love, from Maggie Payne's four-movement Desertscapes, this is the final movement, Devil's Playground. Programming. I would encourage all of our listeners to go to the Lorelei Ensemble website. You can check out past programs and you'll find that they are fascinating. I know you like to have a human narrative. You kind of just mentioned that before. There are programs that are not just a cappella, as I said earlier, with different instruments mixed in. Why don't you take the new recording? Because the new recording, Impermanence, is actually set up as one of your programs. It's not just a smattering of choral works. Talk about how you approach these, and maybe you can use the new recording as an example of how these come together. I know they're all different, but you're behind programming those.
Right. I don't think there's any one way that I would conceive of these programs. There are piles of repertoire right on my piano, and I find works that compel me and I sort of set them aside until I have a concept that I really feel that I can run with. And often one piece will drive that. In the case of this album, the commissioned work by Peter Gilbert, Tsukimi, is one that we premiered back in 2013. And I had designed a program at that time that included some works of Dufay, but quite a bit more from the Turin Codex that is also featured on this album. But the CD ends up being something that has evolved even further from that original program, because I've, you know, really over the course of the last 3 to 5 years been mulling over this concept of impermanence, this concept of migration of people and people seeking refuge, and just noticing, you know, whether it's listening to the radio or a podcast or doing my own reading about events in our current world, these themes that seem to reemerge again and again. And I couldn't let go of that concept, which I had originally programmed in 2013. And I continued to refine a concept for this album that I felt could really showcase that piece. So Peter's commission is 8 settings, little miniature settings of Waka poetry, which is from about 800 to 1200 AD when that poetry was written. And each of them a miniature poem that talks about a moment when a human being is reflecting on their life, but also, you know, in the light of the moon, this reflecting surface that is a floating world that seems to never settle, right? Mm-hmm. That is always, always shifting. And in that, you know, I've been spending more time with the motets of Dufay and just noticing the unbelievable shifting of his style and his willingness to experiment with texture and form and harmonic color, and then learning more about the Turin manuscript, which is the other featured collection on this album, and that collection being one that just isolated as a repertoire has a way of dancing off the page. It feels very light and fluid, and it escapes organization when you're listening to it. It's hard to hear where the bar line is. There's something about it that feels like it slips through your fingers. And so these repertoires for me sonically have a relationship, but they also historically have relationships in the stories of the people that created them and their own movement across borders in seek of a new life, a new career. We also have the repertoire that bookends the album by Toru Takemitsu, these two wordless vocalizes about the wind horse, which Tibetan nomads would set up this long string of scarves. And whichever way the wind blew the scarves, that is the next direction they would walk to set up their next camp, the next place that they would stay, and always temporarily. And so this idea of being a nomad, of being a pilgrim, of being a migrant, you know, often we hear these stories and we think of them as so far from ourselves. But I think in current events, I haven't been able to escape in recent years how unbelievably ongoing and prevalent this idea of migration is, not only to our what the stories that we're hearing in the news. It feels, you know, like that could be happening in another country, but it's actually happening so close to home. And in almost every story I listen to, I feel like I can hear that theme of people seeking a place to settle. And this idea of permanently settling seems less and less common for, you know, whether we want to think about the environment, we want to think about escaping persecution. And these are not stories of our past. These are stories that have been part of the human story for centuries. That to me is what grabbed me and brought me towards this particular concept. And I think many of my conceptual programs come from something like that, where I just feel like I'm experiencing, you know, a returning awareness of a certain word or idea that seems to be pervading human experience on many levels. And I hopefully to tell a story that is meaningful to a lot of different people coming from diverse perspectives.
Yeah, and I think that's the fascinating thing when you look at the programs, is just what you said, is it may start with a couple music selections that you want to try to work around, but then you kind of build this narrative around it. And the range is fascinating in some of the programs. I mean, just this the new recording, the Impermanence one, you know, you mentioned how you had the Peter Gilbert piece and you have this anonymous music from the Turin manuscript and the Dufay motets, but then to throw in, I mean, many people may not know that the Japanese composer Toru Takemitsu even wrote any choral music, because all you hear is the orchestral stuff, and hear this little spice in there of these two wordless pieces. And that holds true, again, for all the programs that you have listed on your website that you've done in the past, and just building them. It must be a little bit daunting to build a new one. it's probably exciting, but it's a little bit daunting probably too.
Yeah, and it's often a long process. Like I say, I think sometimes I put a program out there in live performance, and then I think, oh, I want to refine that.
Yeah.
Designing something for an album, I think, is very different than designing something for a live performance also, where we might have more interludes or different movement that helps tell the story that we're trying to tell. And yes, you know, I have these moments of, I hope I can come up with another idea for the next thing. But the truth is that just our humanness as performers, you know, we have things that we're waiting to say, and it's just a matter of figuring out, you know, that next thing that we as an ensemble, you know, are ready to say and offer to the artistic community and say, what do you think about this concept? And to turn it over in diverse repertoires, not to just fit with the concept within a program of repertoire that sort of all comes from the same origin. I think it's important to me that if I'm going to turn a concept like that over, I need to allow myself to do that in more than one context to feel like I've really worked my way through it.
Back to the Lorelei Ensemble's latest CD titled Impermanence, here are two movements from Peter Gilbert's work Tsukimi, setting traditional Japanese texts celebrating the viewing of the moon. Lorelei Ensemble is led by their artistic director and my guest today, Beth Willer. So you've intimated that the creative will is there. I mean, what do you see ahead? I mean, when you started this in 2007, I'm not sure you could have said in 2018 we'll still be going strong. But, I mean, you're going to keep this going for a while? Is that the thought among you?
I said at our 10th birthday party last year, I said I never at the beginning said, what is this going to look like in 10 years?
Right.
And I said, I'm not going to miss that opportunity again. I'm asking myself right now, what do I want this to look like in 10 years? And I honestly think we're just starting to really hone in on specifically what it is that we are doing. And it's not just commissioning music, and it's not just reimagining old music. I think it's actually a broader mission to create a new normal for women in music and to think about how it is that we participate in this industry. And obviously there's a lot of conversation about how women participate in a lot of parts of our society right now. And I think, you know, we're lucky to be doing this work at this time. So I actually am finding myself moving towards a number of commissions right now that are delving into some specific voices and stories of women. We've got a project that's going to be connected to the 100th anniversary of the first women's vote. We're looking at some new settings of Anne Carson's translation of Sappho fragments. It's interesting for me because I really started this work resistant of making our identity as women too strong a part of the programming. That's not why I'm doing it. You know, I'm not doing this work with these women in order to have a feminist platform. But the truth is that we want to tell stories that we feel are our own and that we have some ownership in those narratives. And so I think that's really driven me for the next several years, at least, towards some commissions that I think delve more deeply into feminist perspective and feminist progress. And that'll be exciting. And I think, you know, you can expect to see us doing more work on maybe a little higher profile with some symphony orchestras. So that's exciting. certainly expanding our touring work in the U.S. and hopefully abroad as well.
Well, keep it going. It's all great stuff. And
thank you.
Yeah. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk with, but could. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? You can get flooded if you think about it. But I'm just curious.
That's a great question.
Usually one name will pop in and then you get a lot of names and you start overthinking it. But, you know, just when I ask that, when I ask
just think of the one name who I would talk to.
Well, if no one comes
to... come back? I'll think of something if you ask me the second question, and then I'll come back to it.
Well, second question's non-musical. Everybody interviewing Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy, not only with Laurel Ensemble, but teaching as well and all that. But when you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but pull yourself away for a few moments, what do you do if you need to pull yourself away?
My first thing when I have a few hours would be to take a long bike ride.
Oh, okay.
I live in central Pennsylvania. I've got incredibly beautiful rural roads to ride on, and that can be a great release for me.
Okay. Yeah. So I can rephrase the first question. If you had to take a bike ride with somebody from the past.
Man, my problem is I'm staring at like a bookshelf of like choral composers, which is not who I would want to talk to. Oh, man.
Well, maybe it is one of those great composers to try to spur them as to if they would think of writing for women's voices. I mean, you know, I mean, Brahms dabbled with it and things like that, but on a more serious level, not just folk song settings and things like that, you know.
Right. Well, I do think that one composer that I did write some excellent music for women's voices, but not necessarily women's vocal ensemble. If I could sit down and have a conversation with Claudia Monteverdi, as someone who really turned an unbelievable corner in the repertoire in terms of incorporating drama and the character of the individual into sacred music.
Yeah.
I think what he did at the turn of the 17th century, I can't think of another moment in repertoire that has, you know, stopped me in my tracks as someone studying the repertoire, but I can only imagine at that time what people were thinking when they first heard his music following the repertoire of the 16th century and the polyphony of people like Palestrina. And so I think I would love to sit with him and understand how he made that decision to create something that was so far off the beaten path and really messing with the norms of the church and messing with the norms of, I suppose they didn't call it classical music at that time, but that serious art music. And he really turned it on its head in a way that nobody else dared, I would say, until that time.
Yeah, and he would have never done it because of when he lived, but if he had written either what he knew as an opera or some kind of narrative for just female voices, it would have been fantastic because of the expression he was able to pull out, you know, of what he did. Well, I'm glad we finally found somebody. not sure what a bike rider he was.
Yeah, probably not.
Beth Willard, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for your interest in Lorelei.
Beth Willer, Artistic Director of Lorelei Ensemble. You can find out more about them, where they'll be performing, and check out their recordings at their website, LoreleiEnsemble.com. Their latest CD, Impermanence, is on the Sono Luminous label. That can be checked out at SonoLuminous.com. I'll leave you with two real finds from that disc, at least for me. The two vocalese from the work titled Wind Horse, The Divine Practice of Tibetan Nomads Deciding Where They Should Go Next. Music of the late 20th century Japanese composer Toro Takumitsu. These two vocalese exist at opposite ends of the program on the CD, but we'll listen to them both together here. Lorelei Ensemble is led by their artistic director and my guest today, Beth Willer. As always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.